which she'd never driven before in her life. So she had a time set for the test. In the meantime, she had to go and find out how to drive. And she went to one of the, I think it was Biggs Motors or somebody like that in Vancouver, and got their agreement to let her be tested by one of their drivers. And they went out on a foggy sort of day out to Spanish Banks, and she was passed as able to handle it. Mm-hmm. She had to back it up a hill and back it down a hill, back it around corners and everything with all her double D clutching and everything else. Mm-hmm. And she went to take a test and got froze. She just froze. Mm-hmm. And she failed. And therefore was told that she wouldn't be going. And she just couldn't believe that because she knew she could pass. And she went after the lady concerned and finally got her to agree to a second test, mm-hmm. which she passed without any trouble. And she left Vancouver on her way east to sail from Halifax when Pearl Harbor occurred. And then she didn't know whether to come back to the West Coast, where her parents were, to Victoria, or to continue on going east, because papers were talking about Japs invading the west coast of Canada. Mm-hmm. And she and the other Vancouver girls, they decided they'd carry on because either their husbands or their fellows they were engaged to were over in England, so they decided to carry on. Mm-hmm. And one of the girls was a sister of Cess Merritt, the BC fellow. She was on the train. And
the Merritt of the South Saskatchewan?
That's right, of the Seaforth, who went to South Saskatchewan to take command. He was a Seaforth.
Was
he? Well, he was a company commander of the Seaforth who went overseas. Anyways, his sister that went with my wife, and they arrived over in England just before Christmas. And on the way over there, there was a British officer on board the ship she was on, and because she could take stenography and type, she was assigned to him to take his dictation of a report. He'd been in Washington, a British officer, and he had some specialty. The report was apparently top secret. My wife said she still doesn't know what notes she was typing. She just typed.
Scientific in nature? Or?
Yes, partly scientific, connected with munitions. Mm-hmm. And she looked after all his typing all the way over.
Do you remember his name at all?
My wife could tell you.
Okay, I'll ask her to come back.
But some years later, I met the man, mm-hmm. quite by chance. It was very interesting. He was a spitting image of Anthony Eden.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he could have been a brother, mm-hmm. twin brother. Anyway, she arrived over just before Christmas and contacted me, and she came down to the Seaforth at Danny House, and we had a lovely Christmas party.
Terrible noise. Maybe I better stop for a minute and wait for her. This is Chris Bell again. We had to cut her short on Monday, but we'll pick it up again today. It's June the 10th, 1982. I'm talking with Colonel F.N. Pope. We're at his home just off Dallas Road in Victoria. And last day we were talking about Colonel Pope's wife and how she joined him in Britain. And I believe we got to the point, Colonel Pope, that she was working. She had been waylaid by a scientist or some armaments minister who looked like Anthony Eden, I think.
He looked like Anthony Eden.
It wasn't quite.
He was a British Army officer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And she did the typing for him on the way over there. And once the ship landed, she headed south to report to the Motorized Transport Corps, which is a total volunteer ladies' operation,
mm-hmm.
no pay. And
how did she exist then? Did she live with your mother? Or?
I fortunately was able to finance her out of my new pay as a two-bit wonder. And She used to join me at weekends down on the South Coast, as happened with many others, other officers. Wives were allowed through into the South Coast. Otherwise, it was difficult to get down there. Many years later, actually in 1949, my wife and I were renting a house in Oxted, and we were out for a walk, and there was this couple walking in the opposite direction, and my wife nudged me and said, "That's the man I worked for on the boat coming over to England in 1941. And I said, "Well, go over and say hello." She said, "No, I won't. He won't know me." So that incident passed. But another time, my wife and I were in London. We were running to catch the last train back to Oxted. And we jumped into the first compartment that we could get into before the train started. And there was another couple, and lo and behold, it was this couple. And I looked across at the man once we were settled, and I said, "Excuse me, sir, but I believe you know my wife." A startled look came across his face, because he was with his wife. And then I established the common ground, and then he recognized my wife. And they happened to live in Oxted, and we had many an enjoyable get-together in subsequent weeks. But it was interesting. He was definitely on hush-hush munitions and armament of various kinds, and he was doing the report going across the Atlantic, and my wife was typing it, but it was so technical she didn't understand what she was doing. But that's just one little sideline. Another sideline was that my wife came down to visit me. At that time we were stationed on the South Coast with 2nd Brigade headquarters just north of Eastbourne, and my wife and another officer, they were staying at a pub down in Eastbourne. We were on the high ground just north of Eastbourne. And most Sundays, the German Air Force used to send over two or three of their Focke-Wulfs just to sort of stir things up on a Sunday afternoon and make sure that...
Fighters of honor?
Fighters.
190s?
I don't really know. They sounded like broken down Fords. Well, they used to come in at sea level, stay over a place called Seaford, fly up through the valley there, and then come over the downs, down onto Eastbourne, drop their bombs, and go back across the channel. We thought it was a graduating class from one of their air fighter training places. Anyway, they came over this particular Sunday, and this other officer and I were standing up at our brigade headquarters where we were billeted, and we could see these planes that flew right over our house, and we could see them flying right down and over Eastbourne, and we see the bombs drop, and we said, "My God, that's where the pub is." So we tried to get in to Eastbourne, and of course the whole...
Well, you were with your wife at this time. They were there, and you thought that...
They were there waiting for us to go and meet them for lunch.
Uh-huh.
This happened about 12 o'clock, and we were due to meet them about 1.
Mm-hmm.
But we took off right away as soon as we saw those bombs drop, and we tried to get into Eastbourne, and we couldn't get in because the Home Guard had blocked off the main roads coming in. So we circled around east of Eastbourne to a place called Pevensey and came in along the coast road from Pevensey into Eastbourne and got to our favorite pub there where the wives were billeted for the weekend, and not a soul. Glass all blown out in the pub. Glass in the town hall, which is just across the road from the pub, were all blown out.
But there hadn't been a threat.
Fire engines all over the place. And you didn't need a direct hit to be wounded or damaged. And we both ran into the pub, couldn't hear a sound. And then one of us, I've forgotten whether it was I or the other officer, said, "How about the cellar?" So we started to go down the cellar, and we heard voices. And there were all the people that were living in the pub, our wives included, and they were all down in the cellar drinking. And, you know, it was as good a bomb-proof place as you could possibly select.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we got there, of course, everybody was happy, and we were the ones that needed to drink. But that was scary.
I can imagine it would be.
Very scary. Well, those are just a couple of incidents.
Okay. Let's turn back to you, okay?
Yes.
Okay, when we left you last, you had just got your tips, your shiny tips. You were a first lieutenant. And I think you're just the main intelligence officer of the Sea Force.
Well, actually, I had jumped the gun a bit.
Mm-hmm.
While I was still platoon commander with B Company under Bert Hoffmeister,
yeah.
I developed what is known as volvulus of the sigmoid colon. In other words, twisted gut.
Your father had that, didn't he?
That's what I believe.
Yeah.
And I was at my girlfriend's house at the time, having escorted her home from an officer's dance, Seaforth officer's dance, and I collapsed going across the threshold of her parents' house just near Edenbridge, and I gave her the number to phone to get in touch with the battalion headquarters, duty officer, and in due course, the Seaforth ambulance trundled down. I was put into the ambulance. And then I was taken through the whole blinking army medical system, starting with the battalion, first aid, then to the casualty clearing station, and then to the next stage. And in each stage I was taken out of the ambulance. The doctor took a look at me, pressed my stomach, said, and on I went until I got to the I think it was the final clearing station before you got to a base hospital. And I've forgotten what they called it. But there I was prodded by two doctors who came from Edmonton, and they both decided that I had an appendix trouble. So they operated on me then and there for an appendicitis, which they took out.
A perfectly healthy appendicitis, I should say.
And I gathered it was perfectly healthy, except that they both assured me it should have come out anyway. You don't really need an appendix.
They work on your tonsils.
The only trouble was, not quite. The trouble was, I wasn't getting any worse, any better. I was getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
They finally decided that I had to get to somewhere where there was an X-ray, and that was at base, and that was at Bramshott, and at that time the station I think was near a place called Red Hill. Anyway, they figured that half an hour, and I should be in the base. At Bramshott, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I was apparently in such a state, one of the doctors rode with me in the ambulance, and every bump, I felt as if my stomach was going to take off through the walls of my stomach, and the doctor had the ambulance slow down to the point that the trip, which normally would take them about 20 minutes, took them nearly 2 hours.
So did they not think to perhaps put you under it?
I don't know. Maybe they didn't want to. I don't know. And eventually we arrived at Bramshott at the 15th Canadian General Hospital. And I went in and arrived there about midnight. Fortunately, there was a doctor on duty, and the doctor happened to be, by chance, a stomach surgeon specialist. And they put me into the operating room, I suppose, and I was given a fluoroscope scan, and the doctor, I'm told, swore a little bit and said to a nurse, give him a spinal. I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me a spinal, rushed me into the operating room, and within half an hour of arriving, they were starting to slice me open. The only trouble was, I could feel their slicing.
The spinal
because they had put the spinal in the wrong place in the spine. The doctor didn't quite believe that I could feel it,
mm-hmm.
so he took another slice of me, and I certainly felt it, and he swore like mad, and they clapped a mask over my face and put me under completely.
When you felt it, was it a sharp cutting pain, or was
mm-hmm.
it just a sensation?
No. Well, I felt a pain.
Yeah.
And I woke up 4 days later, I'm told.
Were you in coma? Or was it just...
I was just out cold.
Yeah.
He put me under completely. And that, I've forgotten exactly what month that occurred in, but, it must have been in the late spring of 41.
Mm-hmm. Were you taken off the strength of the...
Oh, yes. And you said, was I struck off strength?
Yes, struck off the strength of... You were in what company now? D Company?
I was in B Company.
That's right, with the under Hoffmeister.
Right. And I was struck off strength as soon as I went to the base hospital. And
Is this when you were posted as intelligence officer?
No, I hadn't yet.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped the gun when I said I'd been telling. I'd forgotten about this particular period. Mm-hmm. And when I came to, shortly after, well, the fellow who'd done the surgical job on me said, well, I didn't do the kind of operation I'd do if we were back in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he came from. He said, however, I did straighten out your gut. And he said, if it happens again, and it could happen again, he said, well, you'll know what it is, won't you? And I said, thanks a lot, but thanks all the same. And he said, by the way, he said, if you're interested, he said, if you had not arrived when you did, if you'd been a half an hour longer on the road, he said, I wouldn't be talking to you. You'd be dead.
Was that close?
Is that close? So I was told that I wouldn't be able to get back to the battalion for at least 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I have to take things very easy. And he said, the only reason you've come through as well as you did is because you were in pretty fit condition. And I said, thanks, thanks. However, I came out of the hospital, I suppose it was around July. I was there for quite a time. And I was rather sickened by the number of officers that I found in the hospital who I think needed a swift kick in the rear end to get them back to their units.
Malingering
is correct.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's none of my business. And I had a good convalescence. My mother, bless her, was informed, because she was my immediate next of kin, she was informed that I was dangerously ill in the Canadian Army Hospital. And she was living in Bedford. And she didn't know where Canadian Army Hospital was, and then nobody would tell her. A policeman had knocked on her door to tell her this information, give her this information. Somebody said there was a Canadian hospital in Cambridge. So she took off by bus, because she's never had a car in her life, and she took off by bus from Bedford for about a 50-mile trip to Cambridge, by road, not as the hawk flies. And having got to Cambridge, she asked questions all around, and of course, no Canadian hospital anywhere near Cambridge. So she made all the trip back to Bedford again. And living in Bedford at that time was just she and her mother. And all the rest of the children were gone, away from home. And then she heard that if she went to London and went to Canada House, she might be able to get some information. So rather than phoning, which we here in Canada take for granted, being English and not used to too much to a telephone, but she did have one, she took the train from Bedford up to London. That's an hour's train trip. And got to Canada House, and there she was apparently told that I was at Bramshott. So she then took off and found me at Bramshott. And she came in to see me. And at first, when she first arrived there, I hardly recognized her. I was just coming up from under. So she must have really hustled to find out where I was. And part of my convalescence, of course, I spent at home, which is a nice quiet spot to be. But I got tired with convalescence. I had to go back to the hospital for a checkup. And they said, all right, you're well enough now, you can go back to the base replacement depot. So I went back to the replacement depot, and I walked in there, and the whole atmosphere of the place was unreal. And I just felt homesick for the regiment. So I told the adjutant that I just couldn't face staying there. He said, you have to. You're off the strength of your unit, and you have to stay here until you're assigned, and you may not get back to your regiment. I said, well, that does it. And I just walked out onto the highway, and I wasn't too strong at that time. I still wasn't very strong. But I found my way, and I got back to the regiment and walked in on Colonel Stevenson. And he looked up and said, what are you doing here? And I said, sir, I couldn't stand the thought of being in the replacement unit. So I found my way back. And he said, but God, man, you're not fit. I said, "Sir, I'm not fit yet." But I said, "Give me a few weeks here, and I'll be all right." And I said, "You're going to be on exercises. You need somebody to stay behind as the rear party to be in charge of it." And I said, "I'd be ideal to be in charge of a rear party. And all of your healthy officers can go with you on the exercise." Mm-hmm. And he said, "You've got something there, Pope." I said, "Thank you, sir." He said, "You are reassigned to B Company." Well, that didn't please Bert Hoffmeister too much, because he knew darn well I couldn't go on the exercises or anything for some weeks. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was about nearly 2 months.
Well, if you were reassigned to B Company, what post did you have? Was it at
Platoon Commander.
Really?
Yeah. I filled a vacancy.
Mm-hmm. But could you work as a... What? You weren't really that good a shape at that time.
Well, I sort of hung around the battalion headquarters most of the time. Mm-hmm. And they were, being summertime, 41, there were a lot of exercises. And I was stayed in charge of rear party. And that merely meant that I made sure the fellows kept out of trouble who were on the rear party. And actually, I managed to get my hands on some old Ape swords. And I started giving sword lessons, because I used to do a lot of fencing when I was at McGill, amongst my other extracurricular activities.
Yes, I remember those.
And I started up a class, and the boys took on, like, you know, I think they preferred sabers to AP. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of fun. And we had to be careful, because we hadn't got the proper helmets and gloves. But we were able to get them a lot of fun out of it, and mm-hmm. kept their interest up. And it was a little different from the usual rear party activities, which get a bit boring at times. Anyway, that lasted for about 2 months. And then I went back to B Company, properly as a platoon commander. But we were moved down to this place, Danny House, near Hurstbeer Point. Mm-hmm. And it was there that I became the intelligence officer. Because the fellow who had been the intelligence officer went off as a Army Air OP, flying aircraft, and I don't quite know really what he was doing, except he got into it. Mm-hmm. And I took his place as the intelligence officer. And I was as the intelligence officer there when Kiki came down at Christmas time in 41. Mm-hmm. And in, I guess it was about February, here again I'm a bit hazy on time, mm-hmm. February 42, I was told to go to brigade headquarters as intelligence officer, and the brigadier at the time was A.E. Potts, Brigadier A.E. Potts, who prided himself on having the best staff at his headquarters in the Army, so that he didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. His staff would do it all for him.
That's what they call delegating authority.
That's right. And he was adept at it. Anyway, I went up there as a relief, because the brigade intelligence officer at the time, a Captain McPherson, had been sent off to British intelligence school up in Derbyshire. And when he came back, I'd go back to the battalion. That was the principle. But for some reason or other, when McPherson came back, he went back to the Patricias, mm-hmm. and I stayed on as an intelligence officer, and then I was sent to Derbyshire to take the intelligence course, mm-hmm. and then I was sent to Cambridge to take a further intelligence course, and I came back and I became the full-time brigade intelligence officer at 2nd Brigade Headquarters, and that at that time was just north of Brighton.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me stop you there now. The intelligence courses, they were run by the British?
Run by the British.
Okay, what did they entail? Is this methods?
Well, at Cambridge, it was all on German military vehicles, guns, tanks, identification, mm-hmm. and also how to identify German units, mm-hmm. infantry, artillery, machine gun, engineers, whatever.
Did you speak German at all?
I spoke no German.
Did they teach you German?
They didn't try to. All we were there was to identify from captured documents, from epaulettes, mm-hmm. cap badges. We were given a grounding in it.
And how long did these courses take?
the Cambridge course lasted, I think it was a month. The Mortlake course lasted about a month.
In retrospect, I think they were useful to you?
Oh, yes, as an intelligence officer. And I think they were useful to me even when I got back to the battalion in due course as a company commander. Because having had this training, naturally, when you saw any German prisoners, you were interested in their epaulettes and the cap badges. So you didn't have to ask them what unit they belonged to. You could tell them, you know, I know what unit you belong to. So, and there was always a German who could speak English. Always. It's amazing. And but I found those courses extremely useful. But becoming full-time intelligence officer also had some bonuses. Brigadier Potts left the brigade when he was promoted to Major General, sent back to Canada. And Brigadier Bull of the Woods Vokes.
B-O-K-E-S.
Took over. And he'd been GSO-1 first div. He was promoted and took over 2nd Brigade. And he was a totally different character of a man. RMC graduate, and had been heavyweight boxing champ at RMC. And he tended to be a bit of a bully. But he liked to have men who didn't like being bullied.
Well, as the intelligence officer of the brigade, what was your relationship to him? You've discussed in the past...
Absolutely direct.
Yeah, same as the one with Stevenson.
I went through nobody else. I reported directly to the brigadier. And he had me in on all his O groups. If we went to an O group at division, he took me with him. Sometimes he took his brigade major with him.
Could you speak openly with him?
I could.
I guess he was a man.
And that's, I think, the reason why, though I tried to get back to the battalion, he wouldn't let me.
I think we'll continue on the next tape.